Hello, welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns, and I've got a very special guest in the studio today, Mr. Keith Foskett. How are you doing, Keith?
I'm very well, thank you, John. I didn't realise I was that special, but I'm doing good, thank you.
Oh, well, you're pretty special to me, I'll say that. Well, yeah, now, I wanted to have you on the show because I think you must be one of the most experienced long-distance hikers, through hikers, around, really.
I guess so. I mean, I suppose there's a lot of people that have done a lot more hiking than I have. I think, I mean, each year I don't tally it up, but I think, how far have I actually walked? And I think the last time I did that was late last year. And at that point, I think it was about 13,000 miles or something. So I suppose I am experienced. It just feels a bit funny to say that I'm an experienced through hiker, but yeah, I suppose I am. Yeah.
Well, what are the major hikes that you've done?
The Camino de Santiago in Spain. I've done that three times, so that's a total of 2,500 miles. I did 2 1,000 mile routes and a 500 mile route. The Pacific Crest Trail, which is 2,640. Appalachian Trail, which is just under 2,200. Several hikes on the South Downs. Well, I think I've done the South Downs way about eight times, so that's 800 miles. The walk through Scotland was 600. And there's lots of other things as well. I think if I totted it up, it was about 12 or 13,000, something like that.
I think you can. That's a fair amount of walking, really, isn't it?
Yeah, the legs are tired. The legs are tired.
I bet they are. And what got you into that kind of long distance hiking then?
It wasn't actually. I didn't see people doing long distance hiking and think, oh, I quite fancy a go at that. It was kind of a chain of events starting when I was about 8 years old, I suppose, when, I mean, my parents always sort of tried to get me and my sister into go out into the countryside. We had a dog when we were younger, so I'd be down the woods and the fields, you know, several times a week just walking the dog. Then I got into cycling between sort of ages of about 12 to about 30, I suppose. I still sort of hiked in between, like, you know, walking up on the South Downs, the North Downs away, that sort of thing. No major long stuff at that point. And then I was working in Greece at a yoga center of all places, and I met this guy that was staying there doing the yoga, and he was talking about hiking, and he mentioned this this walk called the Camino in Spain. And for some reason, my ears just pricked up. I don't know why. When he described it, and it just sounded kind of like, if I did that, and it was about a 6 week walk, it was about 500 miles. It wasn't so much the through hiking; it was just the sense of freedom, and how this guy was talking about it, and how passionate it was. And it was just listening to him having 6 weeks of kind of doing what you want to do and having this no set rules, regulations and schedules. And about 3 weeks later, I went out there and did it, and I was just addicted. So it wasn't so much the through hiking thing. It was just the sense of freedom of getting out there and just sort of escaping from everyday life, I suppose.
And what did you find was the biggest sort of challenge? Because you sound to have jumped in the deep end a bit, really.
Yeah. I mean, I knew a little bit about hiking and walking because obviously I'd done some at home. I had a rucksack. I had boots. I'd done a few sort of multi-day walks. The problem I experienced on the Camino, being not as experienced as I should be, was walking in the middle of summer with hiking leather boots, and my feet just got several blisters. I think I had about six nasty blisters on each foot, almost to the point where I nearly came back home because they were excruciating. And I had the same thing on the Pacific Crest Trail as well. So cost me. I mean, I'd rather have gone out there and done it and got the blisters than obviously not gone out there and never know. But yeah, I was a little bit naive in that. In retrospect, I would have kind of wore thinner socks and trainers or trail shoes, that sort of thing. But
well, is that something you, well, tell us a little bit about that, because you've obviously gained a lot of experience. What would you say to someone who wanted to, say, try one of those routes themselves, and you know, obviously won't be as experienced as you? What advice, you obviously have learned about socks and things like that. What advice would you give them, do you think?
Well, bearing in mind, if we're talking about the popular hikes in the world, most people are going to do them in summer. So let's just assume it's going to be hot.
Right.
A good thing to do is join some groups online. Facebook's a great place to kick off. Just put in Pacific Crest Trail, and the list of groups on there is endless. So,
right.
Or if you want to do the Appalachian Trail, or if you want to do the Camino, if you wanted to do Te Araroa in New Zealand, just look on Facebook somewhere similar and go in there. And there's thousands of people that will help you out and ask any question you've got. Obviously, make sure you're fit. So don't, you know, decide you're going to go walk the Appalachian Trail, go out and buy a rucksack and leave the following Monday. You've got to kind of, it's not so much training, it's getting your body used to what you're asking it to do. I mean, you wouldn't go out on a 100-mile bike ride having never ridden a bike before, because your body probably won't make it. And if it did, it's going to ruin you for a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
So even if it's a 3-mile walk, kind of like 4 or 5 mornings a week, and then on the weekend put in a longer one. So maybe start at 4 miles, and each week add a mile onto it. So you're doing 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, up to, say, if you can do 20 miles in a day, with a rucksack, a similar weight to what you'd expect to take on your actual through hike. I used to put sort of like 3 2-litre bottles of water in it to weigh it down.
Right.
And obviously...
So just check with you. Yeah. Are you saying essentially walk 4 or 5 miles every day if you can, and then longer walks at the weekend perhaps? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, it's kind of similar to marathon training. You do lots of little runs, and every weekend you do a longer run, and you keep adding a mile every week, and it kind of it makes your body realize what you want it to do, and slowly it adapts to the task you're asking of it.
And in terms of equipment, what have you must have sort of fined down what you carry and what you don't carry.
A lot of it is down to weight. When you realize what a difference a couple of kilos makes, and if you can afford it, then I mean, I generally try to buy as light as I can. It's not the sole reason for buying an item. I've got some items, you know, that are heavier than a lot of other stuff out there. I just prefer those particular items, but generally buy as light as you can for the money you've got. Do a bit of research online. If you're buying a tent, for example, you know, look at the various different materials. Some are lighter than others, some are stronger. Hiking footwear wise, that's something, along with a rucksack, you really should be going to a shop for and getting both of them fitted. I mean, shoes look great online and, you know, they've got 300 fantastic reviews, but then you suddenly realise you've got wide feet and they just don't suit you at all. So two items you really need to get fitted are a rucksack and your shoes. And the rest is just kind of trial and error. And again, that's something you can sort out doing during those trial hikes. You know, if you buy a pair of shorts for your epic through hike, and you know, make sure you wear those shorts for the 3 months training before you go, because if there's any problems with those shorts, if they wear or rub on a certain point of your hip, you want to be knowing about it here and not halfway through your first week on the Appalachian Trail.
So it sounds like, from what you're saying then, that it's really important to try and prepare pretty thoroughly for one of these really big hikes.
Yeah, certainly in terms of equipment, that's not something you want to be sort of dialing in when you're actually out there walking. Get it all sorted out before you go.
Yeah, and have you had any major disasters with gear?
I haven't had any major ones. I've had obviously any gear failure on some of the remote hikes, like the PCT can be, you know, a right or all pain in the proverbial. On the Pacific Crest Trail, I got through three water filtration devices until I settled on a Sawyer. I had two pumps, like handheld pumps, which just didn't work at all. I think then I had, I can't remember what it's called, but it's like a handheld thing with an ultraviolet light. Can't remember what.
Yes, I've heard of it.
SteriPen, I'm not sure. That was just very unreliable. So, and I just couldn't, you know, every time I used it to filter water, it was kind of like, is this going to work or is it not going to work? And I ended up sending it back just because it was, you know, I needed something more reliable. And ended up with the Sawyer. So there was three water filters. I haven't had any kind of like tent collapses or major tent failings. All my sleeping bags have been okay. I've had a couple of air mattresses spring leaks, but two leaks in 20 years, I reckon, is not bad going. So, and again, that's just, you know, it's a minor convenience. You're going to have a bit of an uncomfortable night, maybe a little bit chilly,
That's right. Yeah, that's been one of the major changes to my sort of outdoor kit. I had my old faithful Carrymat that I must have been 30 years old, and I'd used that day, you know, on every trip that I'd done. And then someone said, oh, you want to get an air mattress, which aren't cheap, I have to say. But I must admit, the switching to an air mattress was a revelation. The difference in comfort is incredible.
Yeah, I had a Carrymat when I was younger and never thought twice about it. I don't honestly think, unless it was a very flat patch of ground, I don't think I'd be comfortable on one these days. But yeah, the air mattress is a wonderful thing. So I don't know what I'd do without it.
So of all the walks you've done, this is a difficult question, I know, but of all the walks that you've done, is there any particular moment or section that really stands out in your mind that as something really special?
I think probably the Sierra Nevadas on the Pacific Crest Trail. So the Pacific Crest Trail, you start, for those who don't know who it is, it's a 2,600-mile walk, which starts from the Mexican border in America up the western seaboard and finishes at the border with Canada.
Right.
First 700 miles is, they call it desert, but it's kind of like scrubby, rocky desert, that sort of thing. And then on about 700 miles, the trail just goes airborne, basically, up into the Sierra Nevadas, which I think lasts about 250 miles, something like that. And there's long stretches where you can't resupply, or, you know, sort of hike down the side of a mountain and stick your thumb out on the nearest road. It really is remote and it's high.
Right.
And that's what stands out. The scenery is just gobsmacking. I can't even begin to describe it. It's obviously extremely remote, so you don't see roads, you don't see buildings. You obviously see a few hikers because obviously there's people through hiking it.
Yeah.
But I think just the sense of remoteness, the sense of space, the quietness, in as far as the only sounds you'll hear are sort of the ones that nature's laid on. And I keep going on about this thing about freedom. I suppose that's because it's probably the closest I've kind of got to freedom, in inverted commas. That's why that particular stretch stands out. It's an amazing part of the world. Glorious.
Right. It sounds incredible. You were telling me, obviously, when we started off, about Facebook and about getting advice about that, presumably because the internet is, well, some places you'll get internet, I'm assuming, and some places you won't. But do you talk to other through hikers over the net these days on one of your walks? Is there like a sort of a moving community going along there?
I know, yeah, when I did the PCT, that was 2010. So there were still things we could do, but there wasn't Facebook groups don't know if it was Facebook groups back then, and certainly I don't remember them on the Pacific Crest Trail, but I know there are groups for most of the major trails, and you can basically keep in contact with most people on the trail nowadays. Yeah, it's a pretty easy thing to do.
Yeah, it's changed in a way, because you know, I guess unless you choose to be and you sort of leave your phone at home, we're almost never truly alone these days, you know.
No, we're not. It's there's pros and cons. I don't think anyone in their right mind would probably not take their phone on a long distance through hike, because it can be a lifesaver. But I remember the last time I remember contemplating not taking my phone was probably about 2008. But now I sort of take it every time, just because it is a lifesaver. But I suppose it does take a little bit of the detachment away. You know, a lot of people go out there to escape, me included. And
yeah.
It's a tough one. It's a difficult one. It's a difficult one.
I don't know, when you're at night in your tent, when you're just settling down, can you, at least if you've got your phone with you, things like that, you can listen to a bit of music or something like that these days.
Well, that's right. I mean, I remember, makes me sound old, but I remember the days where I used to take, you know, I used to go hiking, I used to take a paperback. I used to take a torch. I used to take a camera. And the amount of stuff that a smartphone does now is just ridiculous. I mean, I can read books on my phone now, because I have my Kindle app on there. Yes. It's got a torch of sorts. You wouldn't get a night hike with it, but there's a torch of sorts on there. It's got music on there, and you know, you could obviously through hike without a phone, but it's,
it would be pretty bizarre these days, wouldn't it?
It would, yeah, it would. And the amount, so the amount of weight it saves is ridiculous.
Yeah. So you've written 6 books, haven't you, about your various hikes. The last one was High and Low, which I read a selection, which I thought was really good, about your trek around Glencool and Glendu, sort of two bothies that I know pretty well. Yeah. And so... Is that it, or are you planning to write more?
No, I mean, writing is my living, so if I stop writing, then obviously my livelihood is going to suffer. But it, I mean, it's not, obviously I enjoy it as well, and there is stuff I want to write about. I expect there'll be more hiking books. At the moment, I'm kind of making notes for the next book, and that is actually going to be about riding. That's going to be about
cycling.
Yeah, my other love.
Tell us a bit about the cycling book that you're working on at the moment.
Well, it was for years, and when I say years, since I was about 16, 17 years old, I've always wanted to race road bikes, bicycles. And each year it runs through my head. And then it got to the point where I was kind of like mid 30s, and I'm just like, well, you're too old now anyway. You're past your Tour de France stage. And then I got into my 40s, and I thought, no, you really are too old now. And then this year I thought, no, you know what, sod it. Every year you think you should have done that last year, and this year it's going to be the last year you think that. So I started making notes a few months ago about what I was doing, and you know, the training and what I'm eating, and the whole plan was to be outside this summer and be racing my bike on the road against other riders. The local circuit is Dunsfold Aerodrome, which is where they it's the Top Gear test track, so they do races there. That's my local one.
You've had to do cyber racing now, is that right?
I was all getting warmed up and everything, and then the COVID-19 thing kicked off, and I'm like, oh, that's not good, sort of thing. And apart from obviously all the repercussions of it, suddenly I couldn't race bikes. And about a week after shutdown, I think I just read a question on Twitter or Facebook, and it just simply said, why aren't we racing online? And I kind of looked at it, I'm like, why has nobody said that before? So all of a sudden, a week later, there's online races. For those that don't know anything about it, you have a bike trainer. So your bike is, the rear wheel of your bike is rigged up to a trainer. So when you pedal, the trainer senses how fast you're going, how what speed, your heart rate, and all sorts of different things. It puts that information into a laptop. You've got a screen. You can sort of see your avatar in front of you and also everybody else that's racing. So I've been doing it about a couple of times a week online. I joined a local cycling club, Horsham. So I've got some sort of advice on what to do there. And it's a lot of fun. I mean, obviously, I'd rather be doing it outside, but I went from sort of, oh, I'm not going to be racing, to, oh, I am racing.
Yeah. Well, making the most of it, really. You know?
Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of looking at it now, I'm thinking, well, it's actually quite an interesting angle on the book.
Yes.
It kind of sort of flips it on its head.
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't get tempted to cheat. I mean, you could put an electric drill and power up the bike with that.
There's people that do it apparently, because the software's reliant on the information you give it. So if you tell the software you're 80 kilos where in fact you're 100, it'll take that into account. So if you accelerate hard, if you're 80 kilos, it'll obviously accelerate a lot quicker than if you're 100 kilos. So yeah, it goes on. I think if there's, they've trained, it's, I race on a program called Zwift, and I know they're sort of bringing in measures where,
right,
obviously somebody is cheating, they get thrown out of the race. So
that's amazing. I was sort of joking. I didn't think anybody would do that, but obviously I'm naive. I didn't realize that people are as devious as I am out there, you know.
John, if you would have told me this time last year that I'd be racing bikes in my shed, then I wouldn't have believed you either. So
yeah, fair enough. Yeah, I could see that. Okay. And any idea, it's very early days for your cycling book, but you have any idea when you're aiming to get that out?
I don't think it'll be this year, because I need to sort of see the sure. year through to diarise events, so to speak. So it's kind of like over the space of a year. So,
right.
I mean, I can start it and obviously, you know, sort of write it up to date. But I think realistically, the absolute earliest would be spring of next year, 2021. So.
Okay.
That's what I'm kind of aiming
for. Have you got a title for it yet? No.
No, I haven't thought of the title. No. No.
Okay. Oh, well. Well, I wish you all the best with it. I hope it goes really well. And I certainly enjoyed reading the excerpt that I read from High and Low. I thought it was really good. And I think you've probably got actually a quite a similar style to the way that I write. So you know, folks listening to this podcast, if you've enjoyed my books, I'm sure you'll enjoy Keith's as well. Okay. Well, thanks very much, Keith. And I wish you all the very best with cycle racing in the shed.
Thank you very much, Sean. Nice talking to you.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.